I think we might need to start back up with your explanation the last time about why you should not take a picture of the sunset, and then explain what you said, and then tell us why, and then we'll argue about it a while.
Okay.
All right?
Yep. Let me just get up my mind. Okay.
So you got the floor.
Okay, let me see. Okay. Well?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. What I said is as follows. There is a prohibition of the Torah against producing the images of the sun or the moon or the stars. Now, there are different... We will go into this as we progress in the Talmud, exactly what those prohibitions are. But basically, there are two types of prohibitions. There's prohibitions against images in relief, and then against images just drawn on a board. In other words, a writing or not in relief. All right. Now there are two these two prohibitions differ as to dependent upon what the object is that one is drawing. Okay. And by the way, this is a law not just for Ben Israel; it's a law for a Ben Noach as well. So long. Just give me 1 minute over here. All right. Okay. Here it is. The Maimonides. I'm going by Maimonides classification. You're not permitted to. A person is not permitted. This is in Laws of Idolatry, chapter 3, Law 10. A person is not permitted to create pictures just for beauty, even though they're not, even though it's not for the purpose of idolatry, because the verse says that the Torah says, and that's in Jethro in Exodus. I can get the exact chapter and verse if you want, but it says you should not make with me gods of silver and gods of and gods of gold. So the verse says you shouldn't make with me. So the Talmud says, what does it mean by with me? It means even if you're with me, even if you believe in me, but you just make these for beauty alone, that also is prohibited. Why? The reason is because in other words, what the Torah recognizes that in the idolatrous, there's an idolatrous mindset, and making images, people are prone to get into the emotion, into an idolatrous emotion. Icons, see, icons produce that kind of emotion. So therefore, you're not permitted to create these things, even if they're just for beauty. And he says like this. So then Maimonides says, now what exactly are these prohibitions? So he says that he says essentially one is forbidden to create to sculpt, in other words, a human being. And he says that's only if it's in relief. But if it was, if it's not in relief, for instance, if you're just drawing a human being, that's permissible. But in relief means it's a, you know what I mean, by, in other words, like a sculpture. Also, he says it's permitted if it's the opposite. In other words, if it's like, for instance, what the, if let's say, for instance, an image, not an image, the dye, a dye with which you'd make a human figure, the dye is permissible because the dye is the opposite. And when you take the dye and you put the substance into the dye, what emerges is a human being, is a figure of a human being. So that the dye is permissible because it's the opposite. It's in relief. The opposite is okay, but not in relief in the regular way. That's why, for instance, the it's very interesting. The Talmud states that Abraham minted coins, and on one side was an old man and an old woman, and on the other side was a young man and a young woman. And the old man and the old woman were Abraham and Sarah, and the young man and the young woman were Isaac and Rebekah. So the Tosafists say that it was not that it doesn't mean that there was an image in relief, because that's prohibited, but it means it said the words Zakain and Zakaino on one side, and it said the words Bachor and Bachura, which mean a young man and a young woman on the other side. The words were there, but not images. Of course, images is prohibited. Okay, now he says like this. He says, Maimonides continues and says, that's with regard to man. Okay, with regard to animals, there's no prohibition. But with regard to man, there is a prohibition to produce the image of a man, because to produce the image of a man is something that inspires idolatry. So in other words, the Torah forbids idolatry in its actual full form, full-fledged form, but the Torah recognizes that man is so prone to ascribe these, to ascribe powers, especially to the image of a human being. Excuse me one second. Hello? Since a person is prone to this, the Torah... one second. Excuse me one second. Since a person is prone to be influenced by this, so the Torah prohibited an activity which might lead to this kind of an emotional state. And the human figure leads to that kind of an emotion. You see, for instance, I saw in the news, I think it was last week, they had this mountain, I think it was in China, with a Buddha on top of it, and millions of people came, and they... Now, Buddhism really is, in terms of the religion itself, is not really idolatrous, because they don't maintain that that Buddha's a god. But you see how people are awed, and this inspires an idolatrous feeling, which is against Torah. The image of the Buddha on top of that mountain, millions of people coming there, and they become very emotionally awed and inspired. That's idolatry. So even if you don't believe that it is a god, just to produce it is prohibited. But that's only with regard to the figure of a human being, because the figure of a human being inspires that kind of an emotion. But an animal figure would be okay to produce. Now, I'm talking about producing. I'm not talking about purchasing. Now, since there's a violation, that's one violation. Now, let me get to the other one, which I think is one that you are concerned with. Now, that's with regard to man. But then Maimonides states, with regard to the sun, and with regard to the... with regard to the moon, or with regard to stars, or the constellations, or angels, then even if a person would not make it in relief, but just to draw it, is also prohibited. All right. Therefore, what I said was, it's prohibited to produce it. Now, it's not prohibited to buy such a thing. Like, let's say, for instance, you have a picture in your house which has the sun and the moon. That's okay. But you're not permitted to draw such a thing. And the act of drawing it is prohibited. So, therefore, I stated last time, I mentioned that there is a problem with taking a photograph, for instance, of the sun. Because if you take a photograph of the sun... And what you do is you develop it. So the photograph itself, by the way, is permitted, because the photograph is not really an image. There's nothing there. As a matter of fact, if you open up the camera and the light gets at the film, so it's going to disappear completely. But even when it's on the film, it's not considered halachically. That's not considered an image, because you can't see it. But to take that film and to develop it would be a prohibition, because when you're developing the film, then you're really producing the image.
Rabbi, yeah. Question right here. Okay. All right, if you can't buy an image, I mean, you can buy one, but you can't make it.
Right, can't make it.
All right, I'll take the picture, okay. I take the film out of my camera, and I take it down to Photomat,
right.
I'm not developing it.
That's correct. That's correct.
So I'm not in violation of halakha.
That's correct. That is correct. Now, you are right. But for me, it would be prohibited because I'm not permitted to cause someone to do that violation. And in other words, there's a prohibition against causing someone to violate a Torah law. Now, the question
they want you to repeat that, but let me repeat mine again. The fact is that if I take it down to the photomat, I am not producing the image they are. But so you said that you would be in violation for hiring that person to do it. But if they're, you said that applies to the Ben Israel as well as the Ben Noach.
Well, to the Ben Noach, the Ben Noach is not in prohibition.
All right, so if the Ben Noach, that's the point I want to make. So if the Ben Noach, if it's a non-Jew that's developing it, you still wouldn't be in violation of halakha.
No, because in other words, yeah, I would, but you wouldn't. Right.
No, you wouldn't if it's the Ben Noach.
No, but I'm not permitted to cause the Ben Noach to violate the law.
All right, but if it's not a sin, if it's not a violation of halakha for him to do it, then you're not causing him to do it.
No, but the developing is definitely a violation. Because in developing it, that's when you're producing the image.
All right, but if you're buying it from, if you're buying the print from him.
Yeah, but when you're giving it to him, you're telling him essentially to produce it for you. So you're telling him to do that. In other words, you are causing him to develop that image. It would be like for me to contract somebody to draw a picture of the sun, the moon, the constellations. I wouldn't be allowed to do that because I'm causing him to be in violation. Now the question is it Ben Noach in violation if he causes someone else to violate?
All right, wait a minute. Let's do it again.
Okay.
If I carry the picture down and have it developed, it's okay.
Yes.
All right, yes. All right, but you can't.
I can't.
All right, thank you.
Okay. That's correct, because I am not permitted to cause someone to cause them to violate the law. But a Ben Noach, that's not one of the laws of a Ben Noach. So Ben Noach is not in violation of it. Okay, is that cleared up? Anything else on that point, or is that
clear? All right, that is clear as mud to some of them.
Really? They have a problem with it?
Yeah, some of them are having a problem with it. I don't.
What is the problem?
What is the problem? Now, wait a minute. Come over here, Lisa. And I'll meet you partway. Hold on. Okay, talk to him.
Hello.
Boy, she got right into that, didn't she? she didn't took it away from me.
Is it? I don't understand because, from what I understand, you can have a goy drive you somewhere on Shabbat as long as you don't do the driving. Is that correct?
No, that's not correct.
No, that's not correct. All right, then I've got that wrong.
Okay.
I was going to say this was the same thing.
No. Yeah,
okay.
You're right. You have good halachic intuition. It is the same thing. Just like you.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Now, did you just try to flatter her?
No, I only speak to
her. Okay. Yeah, I just thought you tried to flatter her. All right, Sandra, you want to say something to him? All right, Martina, come here and talk to us. All right, you got to talk.
Who was that, by the way, that asked that question?
That was Lisa.
Okay.
All right, Martina, come here and talk. Now, you can't talk to everybody else because all of us can't hear, so if you're going to talk so all of us can hear. No, I don't want her to do it, not you. Now, what did you say, Martina?
I just said there are
come here. Well, you're going to have to talk in this because I'm not going to repeat it.
No, she was asking about...
All right, but come here. Just get on...
It was the same type of question.
All right, she's...
All
right, we got, he can't do that.
He can't tell them, but if they live in their house and if they're
going to... All right, if I come in, she's saying, if I come into your house and I turn a light switch on and I'm not doing it for your convenience, then that's acceptable.
That's correct. If you're doing it for yourself.
But I'm doing it for myself. Now, see, I'm going to tell you this little story. When we were in Israel, we had dinner, at this convert's home. And so, you know, they don't have heaters in Israel and, you know, much and all this other. It was kind of cold that night. So he had three heaters out. So it'd be nice and comfortable for us. So when we got ready to leave, we told him, we said, John, we're going to do you a favor. Now, he thought we were going to turn the lights off. I mean, turn the heaters off. We said, we're turning the heaters wide open and all the lights on in your house and we're leaving. And then his eyes got about as big as saucers. We said, no, we wouldn't do that to you.
You know, you did turn it on for them or?
No, I did it for myself. Yeah, but see, we were threatening to turn everything wide open and leave him.
And then what would he have to do?
And he'd have died, probably.
Oh, I see.
See, because it burned his electricity up. He'd had all the lights on in the house, except for one. I told him I was going to turn the light off in the bathroom. And then leave him on in all the rest of the house, but we didn't. All right, here's Jim Buchanan. He's got a question for you.
Well,
how about?
I just want to make sure I understand it. Did you say it's not correct to paint a picture of the sun?
That's correct.
But yet you can have one in your home?
Yes, if somebody, yes. It is no, the object is not prohibited, but you're not allowed to do that action.
But
if it's painted already, you're allowed to buy it. But you're not allowed to do the act of painting.
Well, if you buy a picture of a painting,
right,
aren't you encouraging that guy to go ahead and paint another one?
Yeah, but encouraging and doing are two different things.
Well, I thought that was the same reason for taking the picture to have it developed, that you couldn't do that because you were encouraging that guy to develop a picture of the sun. Wouldn't that be the same difference?
One thing. Are you saying, let me begin, are you saying that you're not permitted to have it developed because you're encouraging the guy to do it?
Right. If you buy a picture of the sun from an artist, then he's making money off of that, and you're encouraging him to go ahead and draw another one so somebody else can buy it. So to me, that would be the same thing as taking the film down and have it develop and encouraging that guy to develop the youth for money.
Okay.
I don't see the difference.
Okay. This is going to be a little tough, but we have to distinguish. Okay, this is going to be a little tough, but it's an important distinction. In halacha, we have to distinguish between different actions. In philosophy and halacha are two different things. On a philosophical plane, you're right, that maybe I shouldn't do that because I'm encouraging him to make pictures of the sun or this and that. That's philosophically. But the halacha, the way the halacha works is it has a prohibition on a specific action. Now, the specific action is actually painting the sun or the moon. But encouraging somebody is not a technical halachic violation. So you'll ask me, well, is it right to do that? That's a different question. I would say it depends. It would depend on the depend upon the circumstances. Do you know what I mean? Philosophy and halacha are two different things. Like philosophically, I could say, well, look, this person is not really abiding by the seven laws of Noah anyways, and it's not my concern. That's a bad example, but what I'm trying to say is that you have to distinguish between halacha and between philosophy. Halacha is the prohibition on a specific kind of action. Encouraging is a different kind of a thing. Encouraging is not to be classed in the same halachically as the same kind of an action. Okay, there's one thing there's one thing to paint a statue. There's another thing to say that because I bought the statue, well, this guy's liable to be encouraged to paint another one. That's already a step removed. That's up to you philosophically. If you feel that you're encouraging him to have bad ideas and to do this, then don't do it. It's a personal thing, but it's not a halachic thing. Because in these kind of things, you know, the halachic line has to be drawn somewhere. If I sell somebody a car, I could be encouraging him to drive it on the Sabbath, but it's not my obligation. There's a certain point where your obligation ends halachically. But philosophically, as you said, that would depend on the circumstances. If you feel that by doing this, you are encouraging something which is harmful, that would cause people to have harmful ideas, then I would say that you shouldn't do it. But if in the scheme of things there's not much difference really, then I would say philosophically it's not a violation, and halakhically it's not a violation. What I'm trying to say is that there are different parameters for philosophy than for halakha. So the important thing, first of all, is to know what the halakha is. The halakha is to produce it, to actually produce it yourself. That is the violation. Okay? Is that clear? There are different... Is that clear, or do I have to repeat it? Hello?
Yeah. I think most of us made the difference. I don't know whether they're buying the groceries or not, but they understand what you're saying.
Okay. Maybe I need to give an example for that. You see, the benefit of halacha. See, halacha is a very rigid formulation of laws, like you see in the Torah. Now, God gave Moses the laws. Laws have a specific form. Now, those laws can't be violated under any circumstance. And even if the reason for the law is non-existent, the law itself that was given by God must be kept. I'll give you an example. Let's say, for instance, the law against cutting, there's a law for Ben Israel against cutting his sideburns off. I don't know if you ever noticed. You notice the rabbis never have short sideburns. So the reason is because you are not permitted to shave the side of your head. Now, Maimonides explains that the reason for that law is because at the time, the idolaters would have those kind of haircuts. So that's why the Torah prohibited such a haircut. Now, even though today idolaters don't have that kind of a haircut, you still are not permitted, Ben Israel is still not permitted to do it. Because once the law becomes the law of God, then it cannot be changed. Simply because when God gives the law, there cannot be any change, and it's not subject to, even if the reason is gone, the law is a law by virtue of the fact that God gave that law. And it cannot be changed, it cannot be tampered with. You have to know what the law is, but the reason for the law does not play a role anymore. The law becomes a law by itself. We'll give an example. Let's say at 3 o'clock in the morning on a lonely street, someone passes a red light. Okay, so you say that, the man, did he violate the law or not? Well, there's no reason for a red light at 3 o'clock in the morning with no traffic in the town. Actually, there wouldn't be a reason for a red light. But if an officer should see the person passing the red light, the officer would give him a ticket, and the person would have to pay it. Because the law itself commands respect. Now, God's law is structured in the same way, of course, it's incomparable. That since God made the law demands respect and has to be kept, whether the reason is applicable or not. That is what we mean by halacha. Now, philosophy is a different thing. Philosophy depends on the reason. There are some laws, by the way, that have reasons built into them. If the reason is built into the law, then if the reason is gone, then the law is gone. I would like to discuss that if we get to it. If I start on the topic that I'm going to start on, I think we'll be able to get to that, and you'll be able to see an interesting thing in halachic structure. But the important thing to remember is that in halacha, the reason is extraneous. The reason plays no role. The law commands respect simply because God gave the law. Reason or no reason. It's like the red light at 3 o'clock in the morning. You must keep the law. So that is the halacha. But then there's another area, the area of perfection. And that's equally important. But that area is contingent upon a reason. So if there's no reason, if you're not causing an imperfection, then you're permitted to do whatever you wish in that given situation. So there are certain things which are rigid as the halacha, then there are other things which are philosophical. For instance, to help man to have the true ideas, that is a philosophical obligation for Ben Israel and the Ben Nova as well. But it's a philosophical one, so there is no rigid form to it. So So there is a world of difference between those two things. Let's say, for instance, to give you an example, let's say in this very case, let's say even though if I draw a picture of the moon or the sun and it doesn't inspire me or anybody in a bad way, it still is prohibited for the simple reason that that is the law. And once God gave the law, the reason doesn't apply. The law itself demands respect that must be kept. But then again, in terms of philosophy of improving mankind, there we're working with different kind of criteria. So someone could argue, and I'm just using this argument in a loose way, but I'm trying to, I think it can get my point across. In a loose way, a person could say, well, look, if this person, it's true this person is in violation, but he's in technical violation. Now, my causing him to paint another picture is really not going to make any difference in terms of perfecting the world. Why? Because this person is not doing this to inspire any kind of beliefs. And in terms of him keeping the law itself, the technical law itself, he does not abide by the laws of the Ben Noach anyway. So I'm not improving or detracting from his improvement. I'm not affecting him really in any major way in terms of his soul. So over there, I'm free to use a philosophical kind of way of approaching the matter. But in halacha, you can't do that. You cannot say, well, look, if this picture, I could draw a picture of the sun or the moon, and it doesn't inspire me, so I don't care that the Torah says you're not allowed to do it. That you can't do, because there is a rigid part to the Torah, and then there is a philosophical part. But God wants us to keep both parts, even though both are dealt with in a different way. So I could say to you that the man who is... See, I can't do it because it's part of my rigid system, that I can't tell a Ben Noach or a Gentile to do something that I can't do. It's a rabbinical injunction. So I am, so to speak, stuck with the rigid law. But in your case, with a Ben Noach, it is the rigid law is only the actual drawing itself. But to say that, well, because I bought this painting, he's going to inspire this fellow to paint a picture, I could argue that that really is philosophically, it's not going to make any difference to this person, and there's no, I really don't have to be concerned about that. If by him drawing, if he was drawing pictures which had idolatrous content, then I would say absolutely you shouldn't do it, because you're promoting idolatry in the world, which is an evil. So then it's a philosophical evil. But in terms of the technical action, I would say that I could argue that it doesn't make any difference to this fellow, because he's doing it anyways, and he's not really in the system. If you want to help him, get him into the system. Then he won't do it because of the right reason, because he's not supposed to do it because it's one of the seven laws of Noah. Okay? Does everybody understand what I'm trying to get at? Are you buying the goods? That's the question.
I think it's a little clear.
A little more clear?
Yeah, I think I think they'll just have to smoke that one over. We got some grins and some chagrins.
Okay.
All
right. Okay.
And as you said, I think it's just part of the halakha system, the real, and you use the word rigid,
mm-hmm.
Part of halakha.
Right.
Okay. We've got to turn the tape.
Okay. The point that I just made is extremely important, because, by the way, I mean, that's as you well know, in the New Testament, the criticisms against the Pharisees is always that they're involved with the technical, the technical law. But the technical law is God's law. If you look at the Torah and if you read the Bible, the five books of Moses, it becomes very clear that the law is quite technical, structured. And the structure is extremely important. So you have to realize that God perfects us through two different systems, and this is extremely important. I can't think of anything really more basic. One is through the rigid technical, and the other is through the philosophical, which is pliable. It is pliable in the sense that you have to apply yourself to the situation, and you have to use your own wisdom in doing so. So there are two systems in Torah, but you cannot say, a man cannot come along and say, well, I don't like the technical system. That's like, if he does that, what he's saying is he doesn't like God's Torah. But there are many, many verses there that deal with specifics, and especially in the area of Leviticus, in the area of uncleanliness, in the Bible itself openly, and in Deuteronomy. Anyone that reads the Bible, I don't have to tell you, it becomes pretty clear that in the last four books of Moses, there are technically structured laws. And this improves, each one of these things improves us in a certain way, in a certain fashion. We cannot say, well, I don't like the technical, I like the philosophical, or vice versa. That is not acceptable. A person who accepts Torah has to accept both systems. Both systems improve us. They're equally important. And you have to know which is which, and you have to become educated and learn exactly what is meant by the technical law, and learn how to use it, and learn how to what the philosophical law is, and to be able to differentiate between those two categories. But I really can't think of anything more basic in Torah. I mean, that's an extremely important point. Okay, so I would suggest that if you're having difficulty with it, I would suggest that you go over this point, and that if there is any difficulty, I would be glad to try to add clarification to it, due to the fact that I really think it's extremely important. What I'd like to do tonight, really, what I had in mind tonight was, David mentioned to me that the concept of the land of Israel is one that that you would be very interested in, and I think it's extremely important philosophically to understand what exactly that means, the importance of the land of Israel, and the way we arrive at that is the same way that we arrive at anything else, through the study of the Torah itself. So we don't just sit down and create our own ideas. We have to look at God's Torah and see what God says about this. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to be interrupting the ordinary Talmud session, and I'm going to deviate and go on to a different point for a while. Then we'll come back to the Talmud. But I was thinking also that occasionally I might do this because it's extremely important to study the fundamentals of Torah. I mean, there are a lot of fundamentals. So we're going to leave Talmud for a while, and we will return to it as soon as we finish with this topic. And I guess this might mess the tapes up, but not too much we can do about that. Okay, now, as you know, there are 13 principles of faith. Now, the eighth principle of faith, and the eighth principle of faith that Maimonides has in his... in this 13 principles, is the fact that the Torah is not simply historical record, and that there is no difference in the Torah between when the Torah gives the list of the kings, for instance, by Esau, it gives the alufs, you know, the chieftains, and the kings. There's no difference between that verse in the Torah and between the verse in the Torah that says, I am the Lord your God that is taking you out of Egypt, the first commandment and the Ten Commandments. That this is all given by God, and because it's given by God, it is not only true, but it contains infinite depth and infinite wisdom. Because nothing that God creates is devoid of wisdom. That is another basic principle of our faith. Therefore, we say that when the Torah gives you these facts, the Torah tells you these stories, or gives you these facts, there are ideas behind this that we ought to search for. And we're not merely to look at it as a historical record. That's not the purpose of Torah. Torah is not history. Torah is ideas and teachings. So if someone should say that the Torah is parts of the Torah, just a historical record, then they would in essence be an apostate. And that's the eighth principle of faith of Maimonides. So what I'd like to do is we're going to take up the subject of the land of Israel, and what I'd like to do is go through the Torah itself and see how this idea develops. Now, before I do, I just want to mention that when we read the Bible, most people that read the Bible are prone to think in terms of stories, like sort of they have like sort of a fairy tale attitude towards these stories. And I'd like to just point out the reasons for that. I think it's important to understand the reason. The first reason is because we learn these stories when we're very young. And since we learn the stories when we're very young, they have this fable story kind of feeling. And when we get older, we retain that feeling, and we forget to revise our study of these stories. We look at them as the same way as we did when we were children. So that is one reason, and that's something which a person should be aware of and should realize that the Torah is written in a certain fashion. That fashion is that it's almost like it's written in scales, in levels, different levels. The surface level is simple, but then when you go beneath the surface, it gets deeper and deeper and is infinite in wisdom. So we have to remember that when we read the Torah, we shouldn't read it as we did when we were children. We have to revise our understanding and our approach, essentially, to these stories. That's the first point. There's another reason why, when people look back at the stories in the Torah, they have a sense of sort of like a story type of feeling about it. And the second reason is because there's a general tendency in man to think of the people that lived in the past as not being quite as real as we are today. There's a general trend like that. The reason for that is because of our fear, our own fear of our own mortality. Every person's greatest fear is actually to recognize their mortality. I was just speaking to a young woman in her 30s who just had a problem with her gums, and she had some work done, and she told me, she says, the main thing that bothered was not the work on the teeth, which was very painful, but she says the recognition that she's in her mid-30s and the recognition of her own sense of mortality, that parts of her are starting to go. And this is something which is very frightening for a human being. And because of it, what man does is he tries to block out certain things in order to not to face that fear. One of the methods that a person uses is to consider the lives of people in the past as not being quite as real as our lives. Because if theirs was as real as ours, and they are gone, this kind of indicates that our existence is just as tenuous as theirs, and we will soon suffer the same fate, which is a frightening concept. Now, it's an interesting thing. There is one book in the Torah that is really dedicated to the idea of man coming to grips with his mortality. Now, does anyone know which book that is? It's one of the books. Every book of the Torah in the prophets has a different topic. And this book, the essence of this book, it runs through the book like a red thread, I would say, the idea of human mortality and the idea of coming to grips, man's struggle with his mortality and his inability to really face it. That book is Ecclesiastes. Okay, that's the King Solomon's book, Ecclesiastes. And Ecclesiastes, that's why Ecclesiastes has a very kind of, people look at it as a depressing tone. And it's, for instance, it says, vanity of vanities, saith Koheleth. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What benefit is there in all the labor that a person labors under the sun? A generation comes, a generation goes, and the earth exists eternally, which means that that a person recognizes that he's just a part of a cycle. The last generation went, his generation is coming, so the person gets a certain sense of weakness and futility in his life. But the Torah doesn't hide anything. The Torah demands that we face up to reality and not try to fool ourselves. So the book of Ecclesiastes is really is written precisely for that reason, to teach a person how to struggle with this greatest of all fears, the fear of a person's own mortality. But there is one verse in the beginning, in 1:11, which really has to do with what we were discussing. In 1:11 it says, in Ecclesiastes 1:11, there is no remembrance of the former people, the former beings. And then it says, and also the ones who live at the end, there will not be any remembrance for them with the ones that exist at the end. Now, it seems like a contradiction, because it says there's no remembrance to the people who lived many years ago. And even the ones that live at the end, they're not going to be remembered either with the ones that live all the way at the end. So it sounds like a contradiction. But really, what Ecclesiastes is saying is very simple. You just have to look into it a little bit deeper. What he's saying is that we don't remember the people of the past. We don't remember. We forget. I mean, we forget because how many people know their great-grandfather? Very few. Great-great-grandfather? No one. So these people are really out of our minds and as if they never existed. But even the people that we know of that existed, somehow or other, we don't ascribe to them the same amount of reality as we do to our own lives. But then Solomon says that, but even the people that are existing at the end, by that he means like us, even people that are existing now, they're not going to be remembered later either. So what he's saying is that a person should recognize the fact that this is all a fantasy. In other words, just like you think that those people that lived years ago weren't actually living as you are today, you should realize that people are going to look at you the same way in the future. So King Solomon is pointing out a little bit of reality to people, that the reason why you don't ascribe the same amount of reality to people in the past is because they died, and you have a fear of identifying with them and then facing your mortality. But you should realize that this is not true in reality, because people are going to say the same thing about you. So what that verse means. So in general, there's a tendency to think of people in the past as not being quite as real. And as a matter of fact, even historians commit serious errors in this regard. Thor Heyerdahl wrote a book about Easter Island. It's a very interesting book. I read it years ago. And what he showed was that archaeologists make a big mistake in the fact that they think that the people who live in the past weren't quite as intelligent as us. And they do it, like, not directly, but sort of indirectly. And he shows how brilliant the people were in getting these gigantic statues to stand up that even scientists could not figure it out. And there was someone who had a tradition that was carried down for generations and knew exactly how to do it. And he told, it took Thor Heyerdahl a year to gain his confidence. But once he gained his confidence, he disclosed the secret to him, and then they did it. And it was quite simple. So Thor Heyerdahl makes a point of saying that people have a tendency, even historians and archaeologists, because they're also people, have a tendency to think of people in the past as not being quite as intelligent as we are today. And the reason is because, again, it's because of what the wise king, King Solomon, brings out. It's because of our fear of mortality. So we don't want to think our life is somehow more real, more full, we're really living. And they sort of didn't live as well. And they weren't as intelligent, and we take away a lot of qualities from them. When it comes to the Torah, of course, it's really a distortion, because here we're dealing with God's book, which is more advanced than any book of today or any concepts of today. And people always try to project onto the Torah primitivism, or they don't feel. Even if they don't do that, somehow or other, the stories of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they don't really give them their due, because of the same reason, that these people existed in the past, and we can't really treat them as ourselves, because then we are liable to come in contact with that great fear of facing our own mortality. So that is the second reason why I'd say people don't look at the Torah, the stories in the Torah, with depth and with understanding. Because they fail to ascribe to them the same type of knowledge, at least the same kind of knowledge that we have. Of course, the knowledge of Torah is far, far deeper. Than Abraham was a much deeper person than anybody today. Okay, so that's the second reason. The third, The third reason is happens to be because of the style of the Torah itself. And by that I mean that the Torah is written in a very strange way. For instance, and Rabbi Soloveitchik pointed this out, but it's pretty obvious. Abraham was, after all, a human being. Does anyone know how tall he was, short he was? Was he heavy set? Was he thin? Was he light-complected, dark-complected, ruddy? No one knows. No one knows. The Torah simply doesn't tell us. Does not tell us. Doesn't describe Moses. Doesn't describe Noah. Does not give us these descriptions that we find in every other book that we read. Even today, literature is, that's part of literature, a great part of literature, description. The Torah, somehow or other, God just took that out, skipped it. The prophets are more. Prophets really have much more description. If you read, for instance, Samuel 1 and 2, so you have, it speaks about King Saul, it tells you he was tall, handsome, he was higher from his shoulders and above all the people. It speaks about King David, he was a redhead, and nice looking. It gives the prophets give more, much more description than the Bible itself. And I don't think that's coincidental. I think there's a reason for it. And the reason is that the Torah was written by God, and the prophets were written by people. Let me elaborate a little more on that point. You see, we have a principle in the Torah that once, after Moses, no new laws or new ideas can be given. And that's why, by the way, the Torah ends with the death of Moses. And many historians, Bible critics, wonder why is that so? Should it end, the story should end when the Jewish people enter the land of Israel, like any other story. That should be the climax. That's what you're trying for. But no, it ends suddenly with the death of Moses. And the reason is because the Torah is not a storybook, but the Torah is a book which has a very unique essence, and that is that it was given by God through one person, Moses. And after Moses, there is it is not the same thing anymore. And the prophets were great people; they were inspired. But the Torah was given word for word by God to Moses. Hello? Is anyone there?
Yeah, we're still here.
Okay, good. Okay, I just
thought... You woke everyone up with the first hello.
Okay.
That was a dreamy message there for a few seconds. No, I'm kidding. Nobody was... There were only 10 people asleep. I was lying. Not everybody. No. But you said hello. I thought somebody, everybody thought somebody was at your house. Did you holler hello again?
Yeah, I don't know why, but I thought the phone got, you know, it's very hard for me to tell. I thought the phone got disconnected. It sounded dead.
No, you're doing great.
Okay. Now, the difference between God's book and the prophets is that God, when God wrote the Bible, he had a focus on a certain development. It's a developmental course. From creation not too much about, through Noah, which doesn't have that much about that either. Then with Abraham, you have an expanse. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. Then with Moses, then you have the whole Torah. So the Torah is not written, God did not write the Torah as a historical record, but the Torah has a certain focus of knowledge. And because of that focus, God deleted certain things that would take us off the track. It's not important what Abraham looked like. That's not important. God didn't want to distract us with that kind of a... that would be a distraction from God's course. The course of the Torah is... The ultimate course of the Torah, of course, is known only to God, and the focus, the ultimate focus, known only to God. We, if we study the Torah, we start to see what that focus is, but we, of course, can't comprehend it as God does, but... Because of that fact, God deletes, there's omissions, gaps, and it's written specifically with a certain developmental concept in mind. That's why you have many, many years swallowed up in a few verses, and a few years expanded in books over a number of books. That's the way God wrote the Torah, because God is concerned with the ideas behind the Torah. Now, a prophet cannot do that. See, a prophet has no right to do that. A prophet has the right, like a biography or like a historian. Of course, he has great knowledge and he knows what's important, what's not important. But he has to write about what's important at the time. If King David's appearance was important at the time, and it was a factor because a leader's appearance is important, or King Saul's, then the prophet noticed that this was an important thing. It had an impact on the people at the time. He has to write that down. He has to be faithful to the record as a biographer. Of course, being a great person, he's not going to write like an ordinary biographer. He deals with concepts and ideas of Torah. But nevertheless, he cannot take the liberty of omission. That would be as if he would be in violation of the fact that a person, a human being, has no right to create his own focus. That only God could do. So that's why the Torah is different than the prophets. The prophets were inspired by inspiration. Maimonides explains inspiration. Inspiration means that the prophet was able to devote an abnormal amount of energy to his task, and energy and concentration to his task. He was able to think more deeply than an ordinary person would be able to. He was able to summon all his energies and concentration. That's divine assistance. He had divine assistance in writing his writings. But it was nevertheless the work of a human being, as opposed, not to be compared, with the work of God, which is the five books of Moses. Okay, so that's why the prophet wrote as a faithful and Torah-minded biographer, whereas God, who knows what his focus is, he omits, deletes, and has gaps according to the way he sees fit. So that's the third reason why the Torah, people look at the Torah as unreal, because have an unrealistic sense about it. I mean, people who believe in Torah don't look at it as unreal, but there's a certain amount of, as I said before, like lack of ascribing of the proper amount of reality to it. And the reason for that is because of the style of the Torah, and the style of the Torah is that things are deleted which are not really in the line of the course, the main highway that God is creating, so to speak, in the Torah. So things that might interest us, like what Abraham looked like, God did not wish to be part of the Torah. And as a result, if a person just looks at it superficially, he's missing this kind of satisfaction. And it takes away from his sense of reality as to the figure of Abraham. But what it should do, really, is it should inspire a person to look into the work more deeply, and then he will see that he will have a greater idea of Abraham in terms of the person and his ideals and his ideas, which is the real Abraham, will emerge from the study of the Torah. But if a person doesn't do that, he's left sort of, he doesn't have the ideas, and he doesn't have the description. So it's sort of like it becomes like a figure that is not real in his mind. Okay, so that's the third reason why I would say people don't give the stories in the Torah their proper place in their mind. All right, now what I would like to do is I would like to take a part of the Torah, and which has to do, we will eventually explain the concept of the land of Israel, and what we have to do for that is to go to the very beginning, which really is in Genesis 12. Okay? Genesis 12 is where God says to Abraham, he says, go forth, 12:1, go forth from your land, from your birthplace, from the house of your father, to the land which I will show you. And then in verse 2, and I'll make you into a great nation, I'll best bless you, I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing, and et cetera, okay? So, here when a person looks at this verse, or these few verses, a person gets an impression, wow, it's so nice. I mean, here God is taking this man Abraham, and he's telling him, I'm going to take you, leave your land, and I'm going to take you to this wonderful place. We conjure up a very idyllic image in our mind, and it's, we think, well, that would be great if that happened to us. That would be just wonderful. But when you look closer at the verse, you see that, again, you're ascribing a story kind of attitude to the Torah. But when you look at the verse does not tolerate such a thing. Take a look at verse 1. It says, God said to Abraham, go forth from your land, from your birthplace, from the house of your father. We have to understand why you need all these places. And it says, to the land which I will show you. Okay? So God does not tell him where he's supposed to go. Now, an intelligent person will ask the question, how did Abraham know where to go? God says, I will tell you. But meantime, he told him, leave. So in the same verse, he tells him, leave, and he says, go where? To the land which I will show you. Well, what is he supposed to do now today, before God shows him? He's supposed to pack his bags and leave. Does he go north, south, east, west? Which way? Where does he go? All right? So when you look into the verse, you see it's not quite as simple as one would think. Now, here's where the oral law and the scholars of the oral law come in, and Ramban is one of them. And
Rabbi, we've got 1 minute.
Okay. Okay. Ramban says that actually what happened was that Abraham picked himself up and was a nomad. He didn't know which way to go. He just happened, he took one direction. And actually it was south. But turned out it was correct. But that's not the point. The point was he did not know where he was going at the time, and he just left. As a matter of fact, Nachmanides, Ramban says, that he wandered around like a lost sheep. And if you take a look at one of the verses later, you'll see a precise corroboration of that idea. We'll, I guess we'll have to take it up next week because I think we're running out of time. But we will continue on an analysis of this whole part of the Bible. Okay, thank you.